Patreon, welcome back. Thank you so much, David. Fun episode. When did they approach you with the script idea? What year?
You mean for the film?
Yeah.
Let's see. The Rolling Stone got published. So Rolling Stone had a deal. We had a deal with Rolling Stone that they wouldn't publish anything mm-hmm. until after the my legal jeopardy was passed.
Right.
So they had to wait because the New York Times article came out in 2008. Uh-huh. That's when Rolling Stone got interested mm-hmm. and they had to wait 3 years for our
sentencing.
For the sentencing.
Adjudication.
So Rolling Stone got published in 2011. I remember it got published while I was still under probation.
Mm-hmm.
And my probation officer saw it and I went in for like my weekly meeting or whatever it was. And he like has a copy in it. And he's like, this is you, Packhouse, you know? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, you think you're famous now or something,
yeah,
you know? Yeah. And I'm like, it's just, listen, I'm just telling my story. And he's like, you're not going to like tell them about how we do things around here, right? I'm like, what are you nervous about?
yeah. Who have you been fiddling with? Who you been touching?
Oh, Luckily, not me. But
did you? It was after that.
So when the Rolling Stone article came out, that's what got Todd Phillips' attention. And they negotiated for like a couple months or something. But eventually, the way it works is they option the rights, right? Yeah. So they give you like 10, 20 grand, whatever.
Right.
And that means they have the option to start production within the next 2 to 3 years.
Right.
And if they don't do it, then they have the option to re-up the option for like another 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And so at first they were planning on, Todd Phillips was, in the middle of filming The Hangover, Hangover 2, when 2011. And so we were hoping that he was going to start filming War Dogs between Hangover 2 and 3, but he decided to do Hangover 3 first because it was a sure moneymaker.
Yeah.
And so War Dogs didn't get start production until 2015.
Okay. And so, it was his company that optioned your life rights.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They didn't need to option my life rights, but they wanted my involvement to make it more realistic.
Yeah. So did you have involvement in the script?
So the way the script was written, so Stephen Chin, as I mentioned, the real guy from The Triangle of Death, when they hired him to write the script, he flew into Miami and he spent like a good like week in Miami. And like every day he would interview me and record all the interviews. And he based the first version of the script on my interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got rewritten a million times.
Right.
And so,
right. Did you have any input in the rewrites?
No.
Yeah.
No. So part of the way when they option it, they are very specific. You have zero artistic, you know, control.
Right.
You know, you can have input, but like they don't need to listen to you. You know, they don't even have to take your phone calls or, you know,
is there anything that you wish they had put in there?
Oh man.
That they left out?
There's so much stuff. I mean, I honestly believe that, they toned Ephraim's character down a lot.
Totally. We were just saying that while you were in the bathroom.
Yeah.
We were like, Ephraim was even worse.
Way worse. Way worse.
Oh,
way worse.
Wow.
Like in the movie, and they did it consciously. In fact, Steven told me, he told me when he was doing the interviews, he's like, you know, I'm not going to be able to write Ephraim like this. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he says, he's like, if I write him the way he is, no one's going to want to spend an hour and a half in the movie theater.
There's no
with
redeemable qualities.
Exactly.
To him.
They're going
to
wonder what the hell's wrong with you for being his friend.
Yeah. No, that's totally
true. They're going to start questioning your judgment.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's a reasonable question.
Because there was nothing redeeming about him in real life.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that. I talk a lot of shit about Ephraim and I obviously still hate his guts.
Have you seen or talked to him since?
I saw the last time I actually saw him in person was when we were negotiating the settlement. I ended up suing him years later after everything was done and we ended up negotiating something very small, nothing significant, but I just wanted him out of my life.
Yeah.
And so during there were some depositions and so I saw him during that time. And like when I saw him, he's like, hey buddy, as if we're like friends. I'm like, fuck you, man.
Crazy.
You know, like you think you were friends, you know, like what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, give me the $5 million you owe me. Then we'll be friends,
right.
You know?
Right.
But like, I'm good friends with a guy who, one of our former employees from back in that time, who's still occasionally in contact with it. Well, he's not in contact. Ephraim calls him trying to get him to come back to work for him. Uh-huh. And there's zero chance, you know, he's going to do that. Cause he has a very good job now, like working for a nonprofit. And, and Ephraim is just like, so out of his mind. He thinks that like, he tells the guy's name is Ron, right? He's like, Ron, I'll tell you what, you know, I wouldn't offer this. He's like, you're making a lot of money now at your current job, but, and like, I would not offer this to anyone else, but I'll tell you what, if you come back to work with me, I'm going to match your salary. And Ron is like, why would I want to do that?
Yeah.
You're going to have to at least pay me double my salary to even consider working with you. And even then I probably won't work with you because you're a piece of shit.
Yeah. If you actually pay me.
If exactly. And yeah. And he's the same exact guy he always was because Ron told me, this is a little story. I actually saw Ron just a few weeks ago. We occasionally have lunch together. We're still friends. And we live in the same area of Miami. And Ron told me that during the COVID times, he had a friend of his and who was very desperate for a job. Ephraim was kept on trying to get Ron to come back and work for him. Mm. Right. And he kept on his pitch to Ron was, he's like, Ron, you don't understand. I'm a totally different guy now. I'm not like the guy I was back then. Prison really straightened me out. I learned my lesson. I do everything with lawyers now, everything 100% above board. I'm a completely legitimate businessman now, you know, that's how he talks. And so Ron, you know, and he kept on saying this, like every few months he'd call Ron and try to get him to
what's come his new back. Business.
So during COVID times he was brokering like the PPE stuff. And I think he's
just
through,
a leech. Yeah, every war or emergency.
He's there.
He's a disaster capitalist.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's a great way to put it. He's a disaster capitalist. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
He was banned from doing government contracting, but I think the New York Times called me up during that time. They were opening an investigation because they thought he was doing business through a front company, which I'm sure he was,
right.
But they couldn't nail him. Didn't get the proof.
I wouldn't surprise me if he goes down again for something.
I'm shocked he didn't go down yet. Yeah. To be honest, I really am. I expected him to end up back in prison or dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think like he's fucked over everybody he's done business with. Totally. Like I'm not saying most people, I'm saying everybody, everybody. Like, as I said, you know, when his philosophy is if the other guy's happy, there's still money on the table. Mm-hmm. So he never stops negotiating until you're ready to walk away and you're furious.
Right.
Even he'll agree to something, then he'll come back the next day. He's like, you know, I didn't really consider we have to, blah, 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 and it goes back on what he just agreed to. You know, like it's just like never ending. It's draining.
Narcissism.
He drains you. That's like his whole. I'll tell you a story of when I first realized he was a complete sociopath. And this is the kind of thing they couldn't put in the film because, you know, it's just like, it's just too over the top. It was like a few months into like working with him. We went to a gun show in Orlando and we were on our way back to Miami and he was driving and it was one of these like really long highways with no street lights in the middle of like, you know, the countryside where there's just like one lane going in each direction without like, you know, a median or anything. It's just like a painted line, to divide it. And he had his brights on and I, you know, their car's coming the other direction. And I told him, Ephraim, you know, you're supposed to like turn your brights down when another car's coming. And he's like, why? I mean, like, I need to see the road. And I told him, well, you might blind the other driver. They can crash. And he's like, who cares? I mean, I need to see the road. And I told him, yeah, but they can crash into us. And he's like, oh, good point. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. And he turns the brights down. Yeah. And I'm like, it didn't even occur to him that he should care like at all. You know, like it just didn't, that's not how his brain worked.
Ooh.
And so I was like, wow. When he said, I was like, dude, this guy has zero like empathy towards anybody.
That's right. And so you obviously know the mistake, you know, a big mistake you made in the first place was just getting deeper and deeper into business with this guy.
Yeah. I mean, I always told myself, I'm like, the more I worked with him, like he wasn't like that as a kid. but like, you know, and I'd lost contact with him for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of getting to know him again in that, or the early days of me working with him. And I realized this guy is a psychopath or sociopath or whatever the term is. And he's probably not a good guy to do business with. Mm-hmm. But I told myself, you know, you can stick it out for a year. You'll make, I mean, he made $2 million a year. Why can't you make $2 million a year? And then, you know, maybe $5 million. Then you'll be set, you know.
Let's get
and
a then bag you can, and then you'll get
exactly.
out.
Exactly. That was my plan. I'm like going to make a bunch of money and then I'm going to quit. And you know, this guy is going to be in my rearview mirror because he just wasn't a pleasant person to work. Besides all the other risks and issues, he was just a very unpleasant person to be around.
Right.
Yeah. He would constantly get himself into fights and clubs. And in the movie, he there's a scene where Dan Blazarian punches him out. Cause like, he's like hitting on some girl, you know? And in real life, he was actually worse than that. He, like in the movie, he like tells the girl, oh, I'll give you $1,000 to fast forward to our third date right now. You know, it means I just met the family. You're about to blow me in my car. You know, like that's like the line, right? In real life, and I'd seen him do this, he would go up to like a couple, like hanging out at the bar, go up to like the other side of the girl, you know, and like pick up her hand and tell her, come with me, baby. You're too good for this loser.
Wow. I like that. I actually admire that gall.
Yeah. And so he would get himself, but he would only do it when he had a few friends around
of
him.
Of course.
So he knew that they would pull him out of any fight that he started. Wow. He wouldn't do that shit on his own.
Right. Of course not.
So yeah, but like he had like zero shame.
Sure.
You know, zero.
Yeah.
Like he just didn't give a shit. So yeah, he was just like
a poisonous piece of shit. It's wild that he comes from good parents for the most part. Yeah. It's just you're born, some people are born with a defective moral, just a fucked up brain.
One interesting thing about it is that his grandfather and his uncle have similar issues.
So of course, it comes from somewhere.
It does come from somewhere, and I do think it's genetic.
Yeah.
Because his grandfather, just a little story about his family background, his grandfather is a Iranian Jew, right? That came to like, I forgot how, he came like, I think in his 20s or 30s to the United States from Iran. Probably in the 79 revolution, if I had to guess. Mm-hmm. And his grandfather is one of the biggest, he's a billionaire, his grandfather. He's one of the biggest slum lords in LA. He owns large parts of South Central.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's how Ephraim's uncle, who's his grandfather's son, has that big pawn shop because it was one of his grandfather's properties. Yeah. And so his grandfather set him up in business. And his grandfather was married to his grandmother for like, I think 40 years or something. Mm-hmm. They had like eight, nine kids together. And then his grandmother decided she wanted to divorce his grandfather. I think there were some like physical abuse issues. Mm-hmm. He's Iranian.
Wouldn't surprise
Iranian,
sure.
You know, traditional Iranian. It's not uncommon. And she tried to divorce him. And then it turned out that she had never been married to him legally in the first place. They had just gotten married traditionally in the synagogue, you know, religiously. Yeah. And so he decided to give her zero.
Got
zero dollars.
That's cold.
Zero. And she sued him. And it was the biggest alimony lawsuit in history. It got into the papers. I think she sued him for $700 million.
Well, she must have won some of that because it's common law, California common law.
I think she eventually negotiated something way smaller than that, but I think they eventually negotiated a settlement. But that just goes to show you the kind of person, the kind of family his you know, he comes
from. That's the stock that he comes from. Yeah,
and I'm not saying all his family is like that. Yeah. I mean, his father is a sweetheart. Mm-hmm. You know, he treated his father horribly. It really was terrible. His uncle is his other uncle, not the pawn shop owner, but the pawn shop owner's brother is a guy named Shmuley Boteach, who is a famous rabbi. He was actually Michael Jackson's rabbi for a little bit. And he's also very controversial. He wrote this book called Kosher Sex, which like was very scandalous in the Jewish community. So like, you know, his family's kind of like, they've got that grifter, you know, scammy side to them. Some of them, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. And there's really nothing you could do. You just got to hope that they don't reproduce. You know what I mean?
Well, they're Orthodox Jews, so they reproduce quite a bit, unfortunately. But unfortunately,
he doesn't have any kids,
say that. But what?
He doesn't have any kids, though.
I think he actually just had his first kid.
Jesus.
So he married a Russian woman.
Yeah. This is all tracks. This is all tracks.
You know, the Russians, they love that.
They marry
shit
for love.
Yeah, exactly. And so the funny thing is that, so I was talking to Matt Cox, you know, I went on his podcast, as I mentioned before. Matt is still in contact with Ephraim occasionally, right? I mean, Ephraim screwed him out of all the money for the memoir, of course, as he did, you know. And Matt told me, he's like, he's writing Ephraim's memoir in prison with him. And Ephraim is bragging, oh, and then I did this deal and I screwed him in this way. And then I did that deal with that other guy and I screwed him in that way. And he's very proud of all the different ways he screwed people.
Yeah.
And Matt tells him, this is what Matt told me. He said, Matt tells him, you know, Ephraim, you can't just keep on burning all your bridges, man. And Ephraim looks at him and he says, Matt, there's a lot of bridges out there.
that's pretty sage advice.
And Matt told me, and it was that moment I realized this guy is going to fuck me too. You know, hilarious. Like, I know we made a deal that I'm getting half the money from this book, but there's no way I'm getting a penny for it. And he was doing it.
And he finished it for him? He finished the book.
He was like already halfway through.
Is Ephraim illiterate? Like, why can Ephraim not write the book himself?
He says he has like ADHD and
which is probably true.
But yeah, I mean, Matt was writing a lot of the prisoners. That's how Matt got into his like podcast thing, is that he wrote his own memoir in prison and then he started writing the other prisoners' memoirs. Yeah. And he figured, you know, Ephraim, I mean, he knew that when he started writing this memoir for Ephraim, he knew that the movie was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so they thought they were going to ride the coattails of the movie and this was going to be a big book and they were going to make a bunch of money from it. Yeah. Turns out that Ephraim just used the book to try to sue Warner Brothers for stealing his story. So Matt actually wrote a book about this whole experience called Dude, Where's My Hand Grenade? And where he details how he got into this whole thing. And where Ephraim, they wanted to come out with the book, Once a Gun Runner, is the name of his memoir. They wanted to come out with it before the War Dogs movie came out so that they could claim War Dogs was based on the book and that they stole the story.
But
and
he's been paid already, right? His life rights have been optioned.
No, Ephraim never got his life rights optioned. Wow. They didn't want to deal with him because he's a pathological liar and he was in prison and they didn't want to deal with him.
So are they able to legally do that then?
Yeah, because they didn't have to get my life rights either. Legally, if your name appears in the newspapers or on TV,
it's public.
You're a public figure now.
Public figure.
And because of freedom of speech, anything can be written about any public figure.
Right.
Yep. And you can't sue them for libel. Mm. You can't sue them for stealing your story, you know? And so he wanted to say that it was actually kind of genius. They tricked some guy who was involved, whose father was like one of the top guys in Warner Brothers. They tricked him into signing a non-disclosure agreement and then like having his, like the, they emailed him the draft of the script. And so they claimed that he secretly gave the script to his father, who was like one of the like head guys in Warner Brothers. And then they wanted to sue Warner Brothers for stealing his script, his story.
Wow.
Now, in order to be able to do that, they needed Matt to finish the book real fast. And Matt was like, this is not enough time. And so they said, you know what? We don't give a shit about the quality of the book.
Yeah.
Why don't you already wrote this other work of fiction about like some like child kidnapping called Stranger Danger that he had never been published. Why don't you just take sections of that book, change the names, put it into Ephraim's book and that'll be enough to finish the book. Right. So like half of Ephraim's book is like literally just stolen. It was Matt's own work, but literally a work of fiction, like literally not even like embellished. It's like literally just
wrote it as a piece. He just needed the book to be able to sue.
Exactly. Yeah, and so they sue.
That's so weird.
They sue Warner Brothers for stealing the story. And then the movie comes out. And turns out the movie is absolutely nothing like the book. You know, there's no even resemblance. Yeah. So they can't sue him for stealing it, for basing it. Yeah. And so then the real genius thing is they turn around and they sue them for advertising the movie as being based on a true story when Ephraim's book is the true story and obviously has nothing to do with Ephraim's book. So it's not the true story. So it's false advertising of based on a true story. So they sue them for claiming it's the true story when Ephraim's is the true story. And therefore it's going to hurt Ephraim's book sales because, you know, it's they're claiming to have the true story when he has the true story. Right. So they try to like strong arm Warner Brothers into a settlement and they almost succeeded. But then what they didn't count on is that Matt ended up getting his sentence reduced and got out of prison early.
Right.
And then he was furious at Ephraim for fucking him out of everything, yeah, of course, as yeah. Ephraim does. And he and Matt managed to tank their lawsuit.
I had no idea. Yeah. We hung out with Matt a ton after we did his podcast.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I didn't know he was involved like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And he wrote Dude, Where's My Hand Grenade is the name of his book. I think he like selling it on Amazon if you're curious. It's a small book, but it's interesting.
Yeah. Did you get paid again? Cause the movie was a hit.
Yeah.
The movie really did well. Yeah. Did you get paid again when they made the movie?
So the way it works is they option your rights, which is like a relatively small amount, the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
And then if the movie actually goes into production, then you get a few hundred grand.
Nice.
So I got a few hundred K.
Okay.
You know, which is not bad. No. Of course, it's nothing close to the millions that the guy pretending to be me in the movie got.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure Miles Teller got a lot more money pretending to be me than I got for being me.
You're right, right.
You know.
Yeah. But did you get to meet him?
Went to the movie premiere. I mean, I met him on set when I did my cameo in the film.
Who are you? It's been a minute since I've seen it.
There's a scene in the movie and early in the movie, like the first 5 minutes, where Miles Teller is trying to sell bed sheets to a nursing home owner. Uh-huh. And there's a guy there who's entertaining the old folks there, playing guitar and singing. That guy is me.
Okay.
So yeah. And the song I'm singing is Don't Fear the Reaper to a group of like 90-year-old people.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
That was the big joke. I've written songs. I've published songs. Yeah, I'm a musician. So I wanted to do one of my original songs, of course, cause I was like, oh, this is my big break. I'm going to have an original song in a Hollywood movie. And they're like, no, you either play this song or we're getting someone else to
right.
do it.
Yeah.
You know, cause they wanted the joke. They wanted
That's
the joke.
Funny. Did you take that idea to Todd Phillips? Did you say, come on, man, let me play my original?
Yeah, no, I did. And he's like, no, this is the only option here.
Yeah, I love that. Dictator on set.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, he was not even willing to like even listen to my music to even
it's
think
cool
about
it. It's cool that they put you in there though. It's cool. Yeah, yeah.
It was cool. It was cool. So I get my 3 seconds of on-screen time, my 3 seconds of fame.
And the whole community that you grew up in, it's kind of a redemption in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. They were, it's funny. So when the movie came out, I went to the main premiere and that was super cool. I got to walk the red carpet. It was actually black, but whatever. I got to meet, Bradley Cooper and Ana de Armas, who unfortunately wasn't there, but not at the premiere, but I did meet her on set, on one of the sets, in Miami. They invited me to go a few times. And so I met her in person that way. And she's gorgeous in real life too.
Yeah.
It's actually funny because she asked me, when I met her because they gave her a very deep spray tan for the role.
Right.
Cause she's a very white girl and they gave her a very deep spray tan. And she goes, she's like, you know, your ex-wife, you know, who I'm playing, is she as this dark, you know, because they gave me, I told them this is a way too dark spray tan. And I told her she's way darker than you because she's actually half African. So they completely whitewashed her.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I watched them, I actually watched the movie with my daughter who's 17 years old now. And I watched it for the first time with her just a few months ago. Wow. She'd never seen it before. And at first she wasn't even interested in seeing it, which I thought was weird because like you'd think you'd be interested in the movie based on your dad.
Yeah.
And she goes, she's into like Japanese anime.
Kids don't give a fuck about movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like the old days.
Yeah. And so eventually, you know, she got interested enough to see it and we watched it. And her big takeaway was the baby that, because she appears in the film and they change her name, but like there's a baby in the film that's my kid.
I didn't know that. Oh,
so they have like a little, I mean, they change her name, but like it's playing her.
Yeah.
And it's a white baby and she's not white. You know, she's like half black, a quarter black. So she's like, they whitewash me. Right. That was her takeaway.
That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did Miles Teller study you? Like
not at all. He didn't give a shit. No, he didn't. And neither did Jonah Hill study Ephraim. I think Hollywood actors only really do a character study when the person already well known.
Yeah,
and then they need to be accurate.
That's
if you're playing Freddie Mercury, everyone knows who Freddie Mercury is and what he looks like and how he talks and all that stuff. So, but like for me, I was completely unknown. And so they didn't even cast a bald guy to play me.
Right,
I mean, they didn't really care at all.
Yeah.
They didn't care.
Okay. So Tell us, let's talk about the contracting before we get out of here. Let's talk about War Dogs Academy. So is this just like a one-time class or a seminar?
So the way it works, it is a one-time course that you buy.
Yeah.
And it's got, you know, a whole bunch of different modules. Yeah. It's, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it's about like 12 hours of like videos and stuff. We have it both in video format and written format.
Okay.
And as part of when you buy the course, you also get 3 months access to our community for free, which is we have an online forum where you could talk to the other people who take the course as well as to us, as well as we also have a retired contracting officer who's on our staff.
Okay.
Someone who used to work for the government for like 15 years and was in charge of awarding the contracts.
Yeah.
And every week we have a live Q&A session with the founders, myself, my partners, and the contracting officer, where anyone who has any questions, any things they're struggling with, contracts they're working on, or anything in the course, can ask questions. So we have that like live element as well.
Oh wow! Okay. Yeah. So and how much does it cost?
It's a little under $1,000.
That's not bad at all.
People considering it's an investment.
You're investing in yourself.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
As long as you're serious about it. If you're not serious about it, don't waste your money.
Of course.
But if you're serious about it, it's a tiny amount considering you could literally build a multi-billion million-dollar business with this.
Most real estate grifters want you to fly out to Tampa at a Holiday Inn Express and pay $20,000 and you know, nothing comes of it.
Right.
This is a business you can build from your living room.
Yes.
Literally. And I don't say that.
And we've done it.
You've done it.
Yes.
My friend does it.
Yeah.
Right. So he supplies federal prisons with food and food products.
Exactly.
So his margins are razor thin still.
Yeah.
That's his biggest issue is that you're not dealing with a high priced item.
Right.
So I don't know I don't quite get it, but he has a difficulty not in achieving the contracts. He keeps getting the contracts.
Probably like, because his margins are so thin. That's why he's winning all these contracts.
That's why he's winning all the contracts. Yeah. And I think, I don't know what his long-term strategy is behind that. Like, it's like he's trying to accumulate all the clientele, but I don't really see how he's going to build in a bigger margin.
Right. So, I mean, there's different strategies there, right? So the good thing about winning those contracts, even on those razor thin margins, is that he's building up a lot of past performance.
Right.
So he's building up a whole history, which puts him in the running for very big contracts.
Right.
And contracts that are so big that only people with that level of past performance are even qualified.
Sure.
So those contracts can be so big that even with razor thin margins, he's going to make a lot of money.
Right.
Or it could be so much less competition that he could actually increase his margins for the larger contracts because the other smaller people don't even qualify. So there's different strategies that you can go about it.
Plus he's building up incredible credit.
Right.
He's got business lines of credit now.
Exactly.
So he's becoming a company. He is a company. And that means a lot. You're getting into the system.
Yeah.
The system of credit that runs America.
And once you have the ability to borrow lots of money, you could do a lot of things with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's take us through just you know, like I'm an elementary school student, I'm just learning this. The different steps to becoming a government contractor, as you would teach, like in the course.
Well, first thing you would want to do is you have to register a company. You can't do this as an individual,
right?
One thing people always ask me: can foreign companies? You have to be an American citizen, American company. It's actually you don't. Okay. Foreign companies can qualify to bid on American contracts. Mm. And you can be a foreign citizen in a foreign country, as long as the country isn't on a banned list like Iran or Russia or whatever. But if you're in a friendly country, you can register your foreign company with the federal contracting system and bid on and be just as competitive as American companies. Mm-hmm. There might be certain set asides you can't get, you know, as a foreign company, like, obviously, you know, if you're not a veteran, you can't get that veteran owned business and things like that.
Yeah.
There's certain set asides that are only for economically disadvantaged areas, which is only within the United States. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of contracts, you're on equal footing with American companies.
Right.
So you need to register a corporation. Mm-hmm. You register the corporation with the federal contracting system, right? You get like a, what they call a CAGE code, which is a specific number that it's like your social security mm-hmm. in the contracting system.
And that's pretty easy to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. All relative. I mean, it's paperwork,
yeah.
You know, and there's some pitfalls that you can make mistakes on and delay mm-hmm. your registration or,
yeah.
And, then you want to apply for as many set asides that you can, classifications that you qualify for, because that'll give you an extra edge in bidding. Right. So we go through that.
Should you pick a target first before you go into to attempt to be a government contractor,
or target, should you, what do you mean by target?
A target product?
Ah,
like a target, or yeah. Should you just register first? Do you think people should just get the ball rolling?
You don't need a target.
Okay.
You know, if you already have any industry knowledge in any particular industry, I would say that should be your target, because you're not starting from zero,
mm-hmm.
right? You already know about, you know, food or, yeah. or, you know, whatever. Then it's going to be a lot less work for you to get to bid on contracts, because you already have industry knowledge, right? But if you don't have any particular niche already, then there's nothing stopping you from bidding on any contract that you technically qualify right. for. And it could be a wide range of things. And that's most people, when they get into government contracting and they don't have a niche, they just kind of bid on a whole bunch of random stuff and see what sticks. And whenever they win something, like my partners in Wardo's Academy, they managed to win a laundry services contract.
Yeah.
And they'd never done laundry services before. They just happened to bid on this small contract and happened to win it. And then they became experts in laundry okay. services, because they had to deliver on that. And then they had to pass performance, and then they start building up on that. Now they're experts in it.
Okay.
And that's their niche.
Okay, great. So let's talk about them. Let's use them as an example of how people just started with nothing, no knowledge, and became a multi-million dollar operation.
Sure.
So they just chose the industry from the contract that they ended up winning.
Exactly.
Okay. So how did it work? How much was the contract worth? And then how did they fulfill it and make a profit?
So I don't remember the numbers on their particular contracts offhand, but the first contract you're going to win is always going to, these days, is going to be less than $250,000. Because anything above $250,000 generally requires past performance. Right. And if you're brand new, then you don't qualify, mm-hmm. right? Now, past performance doesn't actually have to be just government contracts. You could use commercial deals that you've done as past performance. If mm-hmm. you've done laundry services in the commercial sector, the non-government contracting sector, and you have proof of that, obviously you need proof, mm-hmm. like proof, like invoices or, you know, payments or mm-hmm. contracts, you know? Now, if you don't mind taking a risk, you could manufacture all that, but that is illegal.
Sure.
Okay. So I don't recommend people do that. And mm-hmm. I tell all my students much better to take a little bit extra time and a little extra effort to do things the right way than to always have to look over your shoulder. Yeah, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, no.
And if you're doing things shady, especially if you get successful, then you're going to have a lot of eyes looking at you.
Look at Ephraim.
You know, exactly.
Just look at Ephraim.
Exactly. And Ephraim, you know, he could have built a very successful business if he didn't have to be shady in everything. Mm-hmm. If he didn't have to screw over everybody, he was this close to building a multi-billion dollar business he could have built. But he just couldn't do that. Yeah. And he just had to screw over everyone. He had to screw the box guy for $20,000.
Yeah.
You know, still kills me.
it's really crazy.
Yeah. So,
anyways, these laundry guys.
So if it's going to be under 250K,
mm-hmm.
Because that doesn't require past performance generally. Right. Once you win that, you have to deliver, obviously, because if you don't deliver, you can, you get a bad mark on your record. They call it the red X, right?
Right.
Or you're canceled for cause, meaning mm-hmm. it's your fault. And that makes it more difficult. It's not necessarily a guaranteed death sentence, which is how they portray it in the War Dogs film, because it's more dramatic that way. But it does raise a good possibility they're going to have a lot more trouble winning contracts in the future if you have that on your record.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important that you, especially in the beginning, that you deliver those contracts and that the contracting officers are happy with your service.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to deliver, right? So you get the, you know, laundry services, for example.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. Yeah. So they find
the contracts by just scrolling through the
SAM.gov.
SAM.gov.
Yeah.
And, SAM.gov. And they categorize the different industries.
Yeah. They'll, okay. you'll, I mean, when you first start scrolling, it's all random, but you could search for a particular thing.
Okay.
So if you want to look for laundry services or ammunition, you could just type that into the search bar and it'll give you everything there. And then, and that's when you eventually develop a niche. That's what you tend to focus on. You just search for that.
Okay.
And then you find all the things that are relevant.
Okay.
So yeah. So you find a contract that you that is the value that doesn't require past performance.
Yep.
You bid on that. You obviously, unless you already have a business that's providing this product or service, you're going to need to subcontract it, which means hand it off to someone else who is providing this this product or service, right? So in the case of like laundry services, right, they had to find someone who does a company that does professional laundry services in the area they need to deliver.
Right.
Now, of course, there's always the risk that that the person you're getting, you're hiring, is going to try to cut you out of the deal for the next contract,
right?
Because now they're aware of the government contracting thing.
Right.
So what they did was they would sign a non-circumvention agreement to make it contractual that they can't do that.
Okay. So where were these guys based and where was the contract supposed to be fulfilled?
So they are based in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Okay.
And I don't remember where their first contract was going to be fulfilled, but their big multi-million, the contract that put them on the map, so to speak, like their version of the Afghan contract, and not as big as that, but their first multi-million dollar contract that really put them on the map was for the Ramstein base in Germany.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So it was because the United States has military bases all over the world, right?
Yeah.
And those military bases have a lot of needs,
sure,
you know, including laundry services as well as everything else. So,
and this
you
is
can
like
delivering
linens everywhere. Or what were they doing? Laundry
like,
service,
like cleaning soldiers' uniforms, bed sheets, towels, that kind of thing. Like literally just laundromat.
So it's a laundromat.
It's a laundromat.
So they found a large laundromat service in Germany.
Correct.
Near the base.
Yes.
And then
they just contracted with them to provide the service that the government wanted.
And so if the government is paying, I don't know how they charge.
Right.
Is it per the pound of laundry?
I believe so.
Okay. Yeah.
And they have an estimated pound per like month.
Right.
And if they go above a certain amount, that, you know, there's certain like things that they put into the contract for different scenarios.
But say a pound of laundry costs whatever, $5. That's the price that's the government price that they're paying your partners, right? The contractor.
Exactly.
They try to get it for $250 from
that would be a great margin, but yes.
Okay, sure. You know, right. Yeah. It's going to be thinner than that when you're dealing in huge volume, right? You try to get it for as low as you can from the German company who's doing it. And it's just middle manning.
That's all
it
is.
It's just middle manning. That's why I love this shit, dude.
Yeah. It's just middle manning.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. Now, I mean, it doesn't have to be just middle manning. There's plenty of businesses who do provide their own services.
Right.
And this is an opportunity for all the small businesses or, you know, any business out there that wants to do business with the government. A lot of businesses, private businesses, they don't want to deal with the hassle of dealing with the government, which brings the opportunity for middlemen to exist, for middlemen to exist. But some businesses just don't know how to do business with the government. Mm-hmm. And so we also are aimed at them as well. Primarily we're aimed at like the solo entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. But we also have a program for small businesses as well who just want to register their business and provide the service they already provide to the general public, to the government.
Yeah. Cause how great would it, if you're an ammo maker, you know, and you can go around the middleman, you don't have a middleman, you're selling directly to the government.
Exactly. So no middleman is going to be able to beat you on price unless they have a better source. You know, if they find a better source than what you're already making.
Right. So what do you, what's like a good, I mean, war is good for ammo suppliers. War is good for a lot of businesses.
Sure.
What's like a hot, what's a thing that the government really needs right now?
Everything.
Still,
everything.
There's been no abatement.
No, not at all. I mean, the government, their budget goes up every year.
So there's still war dogs out there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, lots of them, too. You know, there's I think something about 1 million businesses registered to do business with the government, something like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, there's I mean, now with the war in Ukraine, there's a massive buildup of military equipment that needs to be made. And because both we're supplying the Ukrainians with the stuff we have in stock, and then the U.S. Army needs to replenish their own stocks because they give it to the Ukrainians. And the war in Ukraine kind of woke people up, because before that, they thought that the era of large land wars was over.
Yeah.
And they thought it was all going to be just fighting like terrorist cells, like Al-Qaeda or whatever.
Yeah.
And so after September 11th, the U.S. military became much more focused on like insurgency style conflicts, not hot large scale wars like the Ukrainian war. But because of the Ukrainian war, everyone's starting to rethink that.
Of course.
And so now, and that kind of war requires massive amounts of shells and everything.
Right. As long as Anthony Blinken and the remnants of the war hawks, the imperialists control the government, there will be attempts at hot war everywhere. Do you recommend that somebody, like, how aggressive should people get? Because I assume when you're dealing with ammo, right? Say somebody wants to do what you did.
Yeah.
That's a high price point, because you have to have the money to float the deal.
Yes.
Or if you want to borrow money, you at least have to have some money of your own to go in on, you know, a deal for ammo from Albania, right?
I mean, you don't have to have, it depends on the kind of investors you have, right?
Right.
So
right.
If you have an investor who's willing to float the entire deal, you don't need a penny of your own money.
Okay.
Right. And so, there's plenty of investors like that.
So what are these guys that built the linen business?
Yeah.
How were they doing it? Were they financing their own smaller deals at first? Or
the one good thing about services contracts is that not always, but oftentimes, services providers will only bill you 30 days later, which means that they bill you at the same time the government pays you.
Right.
And then you don't even need to finance
it. Yeah. They'll just send it off and then you get the money and you pay them out after you get it.
Exactly.
What are the risks to that? The government pays on time?
Generally.
Okay.
Generally, they pay on time.
Right.
Now, different agencies are known to be like, because it's not like just one monolithic agency.
Yeah.
I forgot how many, like 30-something agencies. I forgot the exact number in the federal government. And they all do their own contracting, all through the same system, all through SAM.gov. But, you know, they'll, like the Bureau of Prisons, you know, you're dealing directly with the Bureau of Prisons, and they're paying you from the Bureau of Prisons. Yeah. I remember back when I'm sure it's different now, but like back when we were doing business in like the mid 2000s, for some weird reason, the State Department, whenever they would pay, they would always only pay in paper check. You know, everyone else paid with a wire.
Yeah.
But the State Department is still stuck in like the 80s and they only would pay with paper checks. So that would take longer because we'd have to wait for them to make the check and then to mail it.
Yeah.
And so that would take longer.
Right.
But we knew that about the State Department. So
I hope
that they've changed it by now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the most profitable, or what business of selling, what good service that the government needs has the highest profit margin?
That's a really good question.
I know that's a difficult question, but what sector?
Right. So I'll be completely honest and say, I don't know because I don't know all sectors. Right. I mean, I had a little bit of experience with the arms industry, and fuel industry. But there's many, I never done laundry services. I never done janitorial services or landscape services or provide food. I bid on a few food contracts, but I lost them. So I couldn't tell you which is the most profitable. Mm. I will say that, there is the biggest profit potentials is in two situations. Is one where you find, if they want to buy products and you find a source of products that you can buy from a liquidator, right? So a liquidator, so the way it works is oftentimes, it is very common in clothing in particular. You know, there's like Macy's will buy a whole bunch of clothes and then, you know, the fashion season ends and this is now out of fashion and they want to get rid of it to make room on their shelves for the next thing. And so they're willing to sell it for like pennies on the dollar.
Right.
And so if you can buy something from a liquidator in that sense, the potential for enormous profit margins is there because you're buying it for very cheap. Same thing goes with ammo. You can buy ammunition from military that wants to get rid of their old stock for very cheap. Right. And if you know the industry really well, and you know that you're the only the only person with a source of this low cost goods, mm-hmm. either ammo, clothes, whatever, then you know you could bid it at a normal price, or at least just a little bit below the normal price, underbid everyone else, and still make an enormous profit margin. Right. So that can be very profitable.
Right.
Another potential situation where you can make a very high profit margin is in emergency situations. Mm. So for example, a great example with my partners in War Dogs Academy, they have this long running multi-million dollar contract for the Ramstein Air Force Base. Mm. Is it pronounced Ramstein? I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah, probably Ramstein. So they have a long running contract to do laundry services there. When Biden pulled out of Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and the Ramstein, all the people that they pulled, the Afghans that they evacuated, mm-hmm. like a few, I think it was like 3,000 people, they evacuated them out of Afghanistan. They ended up in Ramstein Air Force Base for a few days while they were deciding where to put them, right? Ramstein Air Force Base was not prepared for this. Mm. They called up the commander of the base, calls up my partners, and he tells them, guys, I need laundry services for 3,000 people tomorrow.
Hmm.
Okay. We don't have time to go through the contracting procedures.
Yeah.
You can give me whatever price you want.
That's right.
The only thing I ask you is don't fuck us too hard.
Yeah.
That's literally the words he used. Yeah. Don't fuck us too hard. Uh-huh. You can make a good profit margin. Just don't fuck us too hard.
And they called your guys directly. They called them directly.
They didn't even make it. There was no time. They needed it by tomorrow.
Wow.
There was no time to go through the bidding process, but they already had this contract going. So they knew, hey, we need laundry services. We already have a contract with them.
Right.
Maybe they can figure out something for these, for this extra services.
Wow.
So they spent the entire night, you know, like frantically calling up every like service provider in the region.
Yeah.
And the Germans aren't exactly a hustle culture. So it was a very difficult thing for them to pull off.
Yeah.
You know, the Germans are very like, they're 9-to-5 kind of people.
Sure.
You know? Like,
they run.
You have to call them back. You have to call back tomorrow. This is beyond, business hours. Yeah, exactly. Right. But they managed to pull it off.
They managed to pull it off.
And they made like three times their money.
Wow.
And they still regret not putting a higher price because they're like, we probably could have put an even more, but they were nervous.
Yeah. You know, and they're in their relationship. Yeah. And that's the thing. You'll build relationships with these kinds of people. Like my buddy who runs the food service for the prisons, he now, it directly talks to the managers for the specific prisons.
Exactly.
And they'll call him like, hey, I need, 30,000 new food trays ASAP. Yeah, you know, so you start building these direct relationships quickly,
Exactly. Yeah. Once you have a few contracts under your belt, they try. And the thing is, the government, they like helping new people, right? Because they know the more competitors in the market, the better options and the better deal they get.
Yeah.
So they're actually generally, you always meet a few sour apples, everywhere you go, but generally they're very friendly to new people, to new competitors in the marketplace. And they try to help you out and to help you win and oftentimes, especially if they have like a long-term incumbent and the person who's been doing the same contract for years and years, they tend to get lazy and then they start having some problems with the contract and they're like, we need to find someone new, And so they're just desperately in some cases looking for new competition in the market.
Right.
And so they're happy to help people. There was one situation where my partners, they got a call from like their contracting officer who wanted to meet them in person at a coffee shop. And they're like, this is kind of weird. We've never they met at the office, they went to do a site visit, but they never met like off base. Right. And so they call up ever since they got involved in the contracting business, they were talking to this retired contractor, the one who's actually part of War Dogs Academy. She's a retired contracting officer. And so she was advising them back then. And they called her up and they say to her, these contracting officers they specifically said they want to meet off base at this coffee shop. Why are they doing that? And she's like, probably because they're about to give you some illegal information.
Mm.
And so they met with the contracting officer, and it turned out she was exactly right. They gave them information that they were not allowed to give them because they wanted them to win the upcoming contract. Wow. Because they hated the current incumbent. And they wanted to get rid of them because they have all sorts of problems. They're like, yeah, we want these new guys to win. So they illegally gave them this info that was like secret that they were not allowed to give
probably
them in order
the bid
to help
price.
Them out.
Probably what? the bid price.
I don't
right?
know exactly what it was, but I know it was, you know, illegal for them to do. And wow. On the contracting officer's part, mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think it was illegal for them to hear them out.
No.
But the whole reason was the contracting officers hated the current person mm-hmm. and they liked the new guys. So those relationships, yeah. as you said, they're critical.
So there's room for new blood.
There's room for new blood. Yeah. They're always looking for new blood. Yep. And if you treat the contracting officers right, mm-hmm. you're respectful, you're responsive, mm-hmm. you know, you don't make them wait days for an email response. You know, if you treat them professionally, you are friendly with them, you make their job easier. Mm-hmm. They make your job yeah. easier and they're happy to help you. Not always in that sense, in the illegal yeah. sense. That's very rare. That yeah. almost never happens that I know of, but it does happen occasionally, but they'll help you in other ways.
And have your yeah. students, new students, since you've launched the Academy, had success?
So we just launched it a month ago. They've brand new. We have had one student who's already been on 5 different contracts and is awaiting to hear back from them. So okay. it usually takes them a few weeks to like process it.
Yeah.
It could take them anywhere from like 3 weeks is pretty quick usually. Mm-hmm. It could take them up to several months to mm-hmm. make a decision. So we haven't had enough time, but we have had one student who's already bid on 5 contracts. So we think he's probably going to be the first one to win.
Wow.
And we have a contest amongst our students that whoever wins the first contract, we're going to fly them down to Miami and do like a whole podcast episode with them.
Yeah.
So, so that's going to be fun.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about the investor angle? How are you setting that up? If people want to put cash into this.
So currently, because we haven't had any students win any contracts yet, we haven't actually completed any investment, obviously, but we are currently just building up a roster of interested investors. Mm. And then when we actually have a contract on the table, we're going to figure out what the structure is. I was on Graham Stephan's podcast. Mm-hmm. You know, he's the real estate guy and I mentioned this idea and he's like, oh, you should.
Cake.
Yeah.
Little twink.
So yeah. Hey, this is only on Patreon, right?
Yeah.
Okay. he's a really nice guy.
Yeah,
he's a sweetheart.
Of course.
But he told me he had a kind of a cool idea. He's like, oh, you should like kind of like have a bidding process for investors so they can bid on contracts. Mm. And, you know, and that way, you know, your students get the best kind mm-hmm. of deal. And so I thought that was an interesting idea. So we're considering something like that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That or you have a fund.
Where yeah, that's another way.
People are paid out, you know, just like it's any other private equity fund would pay you out.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know.
There's different ways we can do it. We're looking at a variety of ways. Right now we're in the stage where we're just taking, you know, interested parties information.
For sure.
And when we actually have a deal on the table, then we'll figure out what makes sense for everybody.
Very cool. Very cool. I didn't realize it was that new.
Yeah. Yeah. We literally launched a month ago.
That makes sense. That's why you're doing the podcast. Rounds.
Exactly. That's why I'm doing it.
Well, we're going to give you a super hard plug here on the free episode. You know, we're going to basically say like War Dogs guy shows you how you can be the next War Dog. Some shit like that, you know?
Absolutely. So perfect.
I definitely, I'm really glad we talked because I do think this is a business. I think it's more important than ever to have your own business.
Absolutely.
Especially into the times we're coming into.
Absolutely.
So fucking get it while it's good. They don't stop printing it.
Yeah, you know, that's right.
So,
and then buy Bitcoin.
Yeah, buy Bitcoin with the profits.
right, way up. Right, right.
So, once again, wardogsacademy.com.
Yeah.
David Packhouse, thank you so much, buddy.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Patreon.
Thank you, Patreon.